Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Darren, age 4, was very curious. He kept going over to his Indian classmate and rubbing his hand over the other boy's arm to see whether his color would come off. As early as the age of 2, studies report, children begin to notice differences between themselves and others. We tell them not to stare or point at people in wheelchairs, to ask us later about the 2 men holding hands. But when we lock our doors as we drive through certain neighborhoods and only socialize with people of our own backgrounds, how can we best teach our children respect and tolerance? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. We are fortunate to have with us 2 guests who are well qualified to help us explore these issues from a parent's perspective. Deborah Batiste is Associate Director for Research and Development for the Anti-Defamation League, and she develops curriculum and training materials. She has 2 daughters. We're glad to have you with us, Deborah.
Thank you.
Rodney Cash is co-president of the Washington, D.C. area chapter of Children's International Summer Villages, an organization which fosters cross-cultural understanding. He has 3 grown daughters. Welcome, Rod.
Thank you.
Deborah, what experiences have you had that have helped you deal with prejudice in children?
Well, I've been a parent. I've been an educator for over 20 years, and I've been a member of my community, so I've seen how prejudice affects young children and older children as well all the time. Just recently, a friend of mine called to tell me that his son, who is one of the few African-American children in a particular elementary school, and the only African-American in his class, I think it's the first or second grade, they were having picture day, and they were going to have their pictures taken, and the photographer gave all the children a little comb so that the children could comb their hair, and he did not give a comb to my friend's son. And when the little boy said, I want a comb too, the photographer said to him, your hair is different, you don't need a comb. So the little boy had to go and tell his parents about it, and his parents took action to make sure that the school and the photographer in this case knew that they had demonstrated bias towards this child. So it's everywhere. It's pervasive.
I like the point you made that the parents took action.
Rod, how can parents counteract the biases of our children's peer group? They come with a lot of stereotypes, we know.
Well, I believe that countering such biases begins at a very early age. After all, parents are the first exposure that children have to other human beings. And so it's very important for youngsters to hear the correct things, but also to see their parents demonstrating through their actions the kinds of values that they would have in their children. Demonstrating equality and open-mindedness and inclusiveness are the kinds of things that I think will foster in children the kinds of values that we would have.
What are the different kinds of biases, Deborah, that we as parents need to be aware of?
Well, the list is so long. I mean, it's just so long. Some, I guess, are very obvious and we talk about all the time, you know, racial bias and religious bias, gender bias, but there are many others. We also have class bias, for example, and many times that goes undiscussed. If your child, for example, starts to say things like, well, all the poor kids do this, do we confront that? Do we say, well, do all the poor kids do that? How do you know the kids are poor? What does it matter if they're poor? So if we're going to interrupt one form of bias and prejudice, we need to interrupt them all. So there are many, many biases. And one of the earliest ones that children do act on is physical appearance. You know, he's ugly, she's ugly, he's fat, she's skinny, and that oftentimes is where parents can begin to intervene when they hear those kinds of comments.
How does bias create obstacles to healthy development in children?
Well, even children who live in the most quote-unquote homogeneous setting there is, at some point in their lives are going to be in a diverse setting, whether it's in the military, in college, in the workplace, through travel. And children who have learned about other people and learned to appreciate and respect diversity instead of being afraid of it will fare much better in those circumstances. And I'm sure as parents, we all want our children to be successful.
Sure.
If I could piggyback on that a bit, the experiences of my children in the high school they attended may be somewhat relevant. My two oldest daughters went to the high school in our attendance area. It's a high school which over the last 10 or 15 years has undergone tremendous changes in the demographics of its enrollment. Looking at the graduation list from my daughter's 1992 class was like reading from the United Nations. On the other hand, my youngest daughter went to a magnet school, which is far less diverse in terms of its enrollment. She got what we would all consider a high-quality education. But I'm thinking that my two older daughters are probably better prepared to live in the kind of society that we are increasingly becoming by virtue of their enrollment in that diverse school.
Rod, what would you say is most likely to influence a child's forming of prejudices? What kinds of experiences would you say are particularly helpful in developing tolerance?
I just think it's important for youngsters to have associations with people who are different from them, and whether that's living in the same community or attending the same schools, the opportunity to see that there are good things and bad things in individual, and skin color or other superficial differences really don't matter too much. Only through the opportunity to interact with people do you have, I think, a fair opportunity to assess character and to get over superficial differences. I think that left to their own, children would somehow work it out. That the idea of prejudice and discrimination is something that gets introduced to them, usually by parents or by society at large. My wife grew up in rural South Carolina, and she said she was from a large family, and the people she lived next to were white. And as early as they were old enough to play, they played together, and they visited in one another's homes. And the race didn't seem to matter. Of course, they didn't go to the same schools. But when they became adolescents, it was about the age of 12 or 13, that fraternization began to end, and the kids went different ways. And it's very clear to me that occurred because of the influence of parents and the society at large.
Deborah, how should parents respond to children's comments as the children are noticing differences among others?
Well, they need to respond with honesty. People are different. They look different. They have different skin colors. They have different beliefs, different religions. So to be honest about that and not to minimize it or trivialize it. I remember once getting in an elevator in a department store, and there was a man in a wheelchair. And my daughter, one of my daughters at the time, was maybe five. And she was staring at the man and the wheelchair. And finally, I looked at her, and I was thinking, how do I handle this well? You know, I want to do this right. So, and I remember my mother would say things to me like, don't stare. Well, my daughter was curious, so she's going to stare. She's a kid. So I finally said in front of the man to my daughter, I said, you're staring at the man in the wheelchair. Would you like to know more about a wheelchair? And the man smiled, and my daughter said, you know, she was a little shy, and she was like, yeah. So the man told her a couple things about the wheelchair, and it was just so much better than saying, don't stare, and that's not nice.
Sure was.
And I think we need to all think about that. You know, I didn't know if I was doing the right thing at the time. I really didn't. And the man, there was a chance he might have ignored or been angry that I had drawn attention to him. But in that case, it worked out. So I think honesty is the way to go, and not to minimize and differences. We're all different. You know, I think sometimes we set a standard up and, you know, who's different from what? We're all different.
And if we say, keep quiet, we'll talk about that later, or don't talk about that now, we're implying that there's something wrong
exactly.
with noticing differences, and
exactly.
that we don't want to teach.
We're sending the wrong message when we do that.
Yeah.
I think there is a high school program that I have heard about where they have kids who arbitrarily have whatever characteristic that's easily noticed. that day will be the discriminated against group. I think it was like a group with whoever had blue eyes or whoever was wearing green that day or something obvious. And the whole day, those kids were subject to discrimination, specific kinds of things. And by the end of the day, then they would have an assembly and talk about how everybody felt. And it was dramatic. It was a really dramatic program.
I think that's good in some ways, and I think it's dangerous in others. I think it's potentially dangerous because there are certain groups in this country who are discriminated against by virtue of their skin color or their religion or their sexual orientation, and it's not a controlled situation. It's part of their reality. It's part of life for them. So while I think it's good to help our children learn to empathize with others, I think we have to be very careful to also, you know, teach children that this was an experiment for you and for some groups in this country. This is their lives, and that can help our children become more socially active in fighting prejudice and discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Rod, how can we teach our children to challenge biases about who they are?
Well, I think if children receive early exposures and teachings that help them develop healthy self-esteems, if they receive encouragement and nourishing, if they understand who they are and they appreciate the differences and value differences among others, then I think they you build in or you help them develop the fortification to withstand bias and assaults against them.
Deborah, let's go back for a minute to the story of the little boy with the comb. The story is, of course, very dramatic. But I think parents might be interested in how the father then handled that.
The father went to the school and talked to the principal and the teacher about it and explained. And quite frankly, the principal took it very lightly. He said, "Oh, I'm really sorry, you know, just an oversight." And the parent really pushed the issue and said, "No, this is not all right. This is not something we can just, you know, shove under the carpet and say it won't happen again. I really want to make sure you understand what has happened here and how it can affect, you know, this young man, who in this case happens to be my son." So they talked about it at length and agreed that they would write a letter to the photographer who does the school pictures and explain just how painful that is and how excluding certain children while including others, even in what may appear to be a very simplistic example, helps to perpetuate prejudice and discrimination in our society. Here is a young man who, for a split second, thought he was not as good, not as valuable, not as important. And we must be extremely careful to not let that happen. And we as parents have to really push the envelope when it does. And that takes time and it takes energy.
How can parents deal with children's fears of disability, Deborah?
Well, I think very young children, I mean, it'd be nice to say surround yourself with people from every single group possible, you know, but sometimes that's back to what I said earlier about starting to trivialize a little bit. So we go out and we make a friend with a disabled person just so we can have that person in our home. That's not going to work. So if that's not natural, if you don't have a friend who has a disability, then there are a lot of good children's books that you can have in your home that talk about, you know, people with disabilities. And in fact, even better is to have children's books where the disability is not the storyline. Mm-hmm. It's just someone who has a disability, who's facing conflict or dealing with a situation that is nothing to do with his or her disability. So the children see people with disabilities as real people who face real, they are not their disability. So that's one of the main ways, I would say, to help young children begin to thinking about that.
I think the mainstreaming of children with disabilities in schools also goes a long way toward helping children understand and relate to other youth with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And that certainly was not the case when I was growing up. So we see that this is helpful, that youngsters having an opportunity to play, to touch, to feel, to exchange, to share with others helps them just become more accepting one of another.
My son is in sixth grade right now in school, and there's a child who just came into his class who has cerebral palsy. But because of her particular condition, she can only be there a couple of hours a day. But she has been made a full member of the class, and the kids interact with her, and it would be impossible to know that she had this condition if we just heard the conversations that were going on. So it's just amazing that this is now a possible thing.
The philosophy of our organization, Children's International Summer Villages, is really based upon the idea that if children from different backgrounds have the ability to come together at an early age before biases really set in and take hold, that they can be changed for a lifetime, that they will come to understand themselves and their role in the world and to accept others for who they are.
I'm going to interrupt you just to tell what the program is, what they do.
Children's International Summer Villages sponsors a village, which is a summer camp with four youngsters, two boys and two girls, 11 years of age, from 10 to 12 countries. And they come together in a camp-like setting and live together, share rooms and meals, and are involved in activities designed to promote interaction. When they return from that experience, we like to have them come in and talk about their experiences, what their expectations were prior to it, how were they realized, how were they not realized, what kinds of lessons have they learned, and so on. We're asking this group of youngsters, how is the world different as a result of your experience? One youngster said the world is much smaller because we've been abroad, we've met children from different countries, they're just like us, we seems as though they're a lot closer to us. And another youth said the world is much larger because our friends are far away. And I have never heard a response that was, while divergent, was just so congruent with the philosophy.
In that regard, Rod, what guidelines do you give children about prejudice?
I can think of nothing more simple than the golden rule, and not don't want to be sectarian, but you say to others and you treat others the way you would like to be treated yourself. And it's just that simple, it seems to me.
Deborah, what if a child never asks questions or comments about gender, race, disability, other differences? And along with that, what parents often feel they're not adequately informed to deal with issues of bias which arise. What if I say the wrong thing, a lot of parents think?
Mm-hmm. Well, in answer to the first part of the question, what if a child never asks questions? I think this is very, very unlikely. Children are curious by nature, and it would probably only happen if parents are shutting down the dialogue to begin with by saying things like, don't stare, don't ask, that's not nice. Sooner or later, the children will stop asking the questions. So I think that's really very unlikely. The second part, I think, is a very important question. You know, what if I say the wrong things? We're going to make mistakes. We're not perfect. We're all working on issues of bias. And I think by modeling to our children that we are all lifelong learners, that we're all working on these issues all the time, is the most positive thing we can do. You know, I've gone back to my children many times and said, you know, I thought about what I said or what we talked about, and I think we need to talk about it some more. I remember a very particular circumstance where I'm almost ashamed to admit, but I will, where my children asked me, they were watching something on television, and it was a crime scene, and my children were watching it for some reason. It was on the news, and they said, do we have to worry about that? You know, it was, and I said, no, that's in the bad neighborhood. And I thought about what I had said, and I said, my gosh. And I looked at the television screen, and every face was African-American. I said, what did I just tell my children? So by sitting down, I mean, I can beat myself up about that, or I can say I sat down and I admitted to my children I made a mistake, that was the wrong thing to say, you know, and that I'm working on these issues. And I think that they learned more from my mistake, perhaps, than if I had given them a pat answer. So be a lifelong learner, model that to your children is the best advice I think we can give.
Right. Okay, Deborah, to wrap up here for a minute, do you have some pointers that you could give to parents?
Some of them will really repeat some of the things we've said. But there are 7 points that the National PTA and the Anti-Defamation League have published in a booklet, What to Tell Your Children About Prejudice. The first point, and my colleague mentioned this one, accept each of your children as unique and special. Children who feel good about themselves are less likely to be prejudiced. So we have to start by making them feel good about themselves. 2, help your children become sensitive to other people's feelings. Studies reveal that caring, empathetic children are less likely to be prejudiced. Share stories and books that help children understand other points of view. When conflict occurs, help your children see the other side of the situation. 3, make sure your children understand that prejudice is unfair. Children love to talk about fair and unfair. So make sure they understand that prejudice is unfair. Make it a rule that no one is to be excluded or teased because of their race, religion, or any other characteristic. 4, provide opportunities for your children to interact with people different than them. In addition to firsthand experiences, provide books, movies, toys, and other materials that reflect diversity. 5, encourage critical thinking. Point out prejudice and discrimination and help children think about what they are seeing and hearing. 6, be a role model. If you tell your child one thing but do another, the inconsistent messages will not help your children learn to be unbiased. If you say that making fun of people is unfair and it's wrong, but you allow ethnic humor or ethnic jokes to be told in your house, your children will eventually be confused by the inconsistency. So we have to walk what we talk. And the last one is to encourage your children to make change in the world, to help others, to be good to others, to work to improve their community, whether it be their school community or the community where they live. Children who are out doing things to promote social change will interact with many other people and work towards common goals.
Before we close, we'd like to offer a couple of phone numbers for our listeners. Deborah, you had a number that people could call if they wanted to get in touch with the Anti-Defamation League?
A general number would be 1-212-885-7800.
Okay, say that one more time.
1-212-885-7800.
Okay, and Rod, you had a number for the national chapter of Children's International Summer Villages.
Yes, our national office in Cincinnati has a toll-free number, 888-CISV-USA. That's 888-247-8872.
Thank you very much. And we'd like to thank our guests, Rod Cash and Deborah Batiste, for helping us to better understand what we as parents can do to teach our children to resist bias. We've very much enjoyed talking with you both. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share parents' perspective.
Are there topics you would like to hear about on this program? Do you have tips for other parents? If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for parents' perspective, you can call us toll-free at 800-791-8573 or email us at parentspur@aol.com or contact us, care of this station. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.